The last paper in this session is by Michael Keyes, A New Kind of Value, Life Functional Complex Specified Information. Michael, take it away.
All right, thank you. Okay, so what I'm arguing is that I'm going to describe what complex specified information is, and I'm going to show that it's the unifying feature of life, and that it's a kind of objective value. And as I describe life functional complex specified information, I'm going to describe it on three levels, cosmic and biological, and then in intelligent life. And then we're going to look specifically at the traits that are shared by the classic values, such as epistemic, moral, and aesthetic. This goes back to the good, the true, and the beautiful of Plato, right? The classic values. Those traits are normativity or oughtness, rarity, and gradedness. So we'll go into all these in detail, but that's what I'm going to argue. And one of the corollaries of this argument is that research into complex specified information, I think, and both how it works in nature and its value dimension is best done in a collaborative enterprise, scientists, theologians, philosophers, engineers, and so on. All right. Okay, the arrow keys used to work, but they no longer work, so I'll just use this. All right, so what is complex specified information? CSI is you have several components. You have to have an improbable arrangement, that is a complex arrangement, but it also has to be not just merely complex, but also needs to match an independent, meaningful pattern. That's what makes it specified. And the outcome of that is something, it does something, it has some function. So, for example, the arrangement of characters on the screen, on the whole screen, this slide, is complex. Okay, so the chance of getting this arrangement just by random letter generation is small. It also matches an independent meaningful pattern, namely it follows the rules of English grammar. And then, of course, the outcome is a communicative function, right? It's communicating ideas from one intelligence to another. All right, so by complex, I mean, again, improbable to get this by just a random letter generation event. Notice that information is produced by exclusion of possibilities. So I said no to a whole lot of different keystrokes, and I said yes to a very small subset of possibility space, of possible keystrokes to make the text on the slide. So information is about exclusion of possibilities. Also note that CSI is not matter itself, because it's multiply instantiated. This information can be stored magnetically, it can be printed out on the page, it can take different material forms. If I stored this information on a flash drive, the flash drive weighed the same amount before and after it had the information, right? So these are all little clues that information itself is not material, although it can be expressed in a material form. Okay. All right, so what do we have here then? So we have CSI is functional information, another way to put it, and it's goal-oriented. It's a non-material feature of reality. It can be expressed in things like gyroscopes, airplanes, things that humans make. So you've got complex arrangement of parts, matches independent meaningful pattern of ways to be a transportation machine, or ways to be a balancing device within a transportation machine, or so on. Organisms also have CSI, that is, complex arrangement of parts, matches independent meaningful pattern, such as ways to be alive. That's a very general one, but you get into specific subsystems within a living organism, and they match independent meaningful patterns, such as a gyroscope, which is interesting that we even have the vocabulary for it, because we independently invented this through human technology. And so there's this surprising match between what we see in the natural world and what we see in the world of technology. So it matches an independent meaningful pattern. All right, so I've promised to look at CSI at three levels: cosmic, biological, and then intelligent life. No, so on the cosmic level, we'll be looking at fine-tuning, and then CSI in biology will be in genetic and epigenetic information, and then we'll go from there. All right, so on the cosmic level, just to give you one little snippet of this, this is Robin Collins using something that Paul Davies came up with, that the expansion, the explosiveness of the Big Bang had to be dialed up just right within one part in 10 to the 60th. So if you made the expansion, if the explosive strength were much stronger or weaker, then you have disastrous results, either too quickly collapsing back on itself or too rapidly expanding. In either case, life would be impossible. This would be like firing a bullet at a one-inch target on the other side of the universe and hitting it. So that's a very complex arrangement, and it matches. But it's not just mere complexity. It's not just mere complexity, but it matches an independent meaningful pattern, namely ways to make a universe that's life-permitting. Okay, so that's the independent pattern. So you put those together, and you have, I think, cosmic kind of. There's intrinsically in that, there's a value to it, because it, as I'll describe later, as we move into the next part of the argument. You can also look at local fine-tuning, so it's not just the basic laws and constants of the universe, but it's also having the right kind of planet, the right kind of moon, and other things, the right galaxy, the right location within the galaxy. So, for example, you have the galactic habitable zone. You have to be between spiral arms within a certain distance from the center and not too far to the edges. And it just so happens that those areas that are good for habitability are also good for measurability. For example, between spiral arms, if we were in a spiral arm, we might be ignorant of the rest of the universe because it would be too much material right around us, and so on. So this matching of habitability and measurability are quite striking. Okay, so we got local fine-tuning. You have, again, a complex arrangement of coordinated factors, just right moon, just right distance from the sun, just right location. And it matches, in this case, two significant meaningful patterns, both how to make a habitable planet and also how to make a science-friendly planet. So the more independent patterns that it matches, even more so does it increase its value. It has greater degrees of value. So, all of this local and universal fine-tuning by itself are not enough to get life. They're necessary, but not sufficient. So that we turn then to biological CSI, needed to construct, maintain, reproduce life. And as many of you know, this is part of an ID research program. But let's look at what those who don't sign on to this program are also saying about biological information. So let's go to evolutionary biologists like these two characters. A central idea in contemporary biology is that, yes, and I'm being cut off here. There we go, let's do that. Is that of information. So developmental biology can be seen as the study of how information in the genome is translated into the adult and so on. But that still leaves open the question of how did that information get there in the first place? So that's a legitimate scientific question to ask from an information theoretic perspective. And so it's not just intelligent design theorists who are asking these questions, but others as well. So these are legitimate questions. Maynard Smith, in a later publication on his own, develops this a little further, this information, the importance of information perspective in biology. So in protein synthesis and in later development, genes are symbols. Okay, symbols. So no necessary connection between their form and their effects. Just like these symbols, natural, there's nothing about those symbols and shapes that are necessary. You can say it in different languages, right? There's no necessary connection. That's what a symbol is. And in biology, the use of these informational terms implies intentionality. Now, he's going to use this in a naturalistic way, but he's going to say that the intentionality was programmed by an unguided process, But of course, he realizes there's multiple ways of looking at this. But he's still using that term intentionality, that there's intentionality means the aboutness or the ofness of something, right? And so just as words in a language context are about something, right? They point to something, that's intentionality. So here we have a biologist recognizing that intentionality. And so he says in the world today, there's two systems capable of unlimited heredity, that is transmitting an indefinitely large number of different messages, and these are the genetic system and human language. Both involve symbols, right, and so on. So again, information theoretic perspective right there. Now, now that we're living in the post-ENCODE world, we know that most DNA is not junk DNA, but the vast majority of it has function, and although there's still some debate about the biochemical function, how much of that is life critical function, but I think the trajectory of research is definitely in that direction. So I did give you one little portrait of the sort of information, how highly compressed the information is, even just in DNA, let alone epigenetics. You can take a single, in some cases, there are single DNA nucleotides that could be used in a dozen overlapping codes, each rendering a different function. And I've given just a half dozen examples of different functions. So in other words, you have a stretch of DNA that might have multiple codes. You might read it in one direction, another direction, or various ways to read it, and you come up with multiple functions coded for by multiple overlapping codes. Now, to get a handle on what this is like, it would be like me composing a paragraph in English that when you read it in the frontwards direction all the way through, it says something in English. But then if you, let's say, read it backwards, it would say something in German. Or if you read, let's say, every other letter or every fifth letter, it would say something in another language. This is an amazing degree of foresight that would take to be able to program multiple levels of code in one section of DNA. And of course, that has huge implications for origins. But I want to focus not on that, but on this as a kind of value as we get into the more philosophical part of the argument. Now, here's what a French information theorist has to say about this subject. He's a materialist or a quasi-materialist, doesn't come from a Christian perspective. He says that information is radically different from matter and energy. He's a leading guy in informatics. He came from from communication engineering field, and then has been applying this to biology for the last couple of decades. So here we have a sort of a quasi-materialist. He realizes that information can't be equated with matter and energy. For example, I gave you illustrations earlier, right, about multiple realizability of information could take different material forms, so you can't reduce it to information. But he wants to say that it has, although it's not matter and energy by itself, it can't exist unless it's physically inscribed. So that's why I call him kind of a quasi-materialist. He's trying to cover both realms. Of course, and then Dembski's latest book is a metaphysical perspective on information in the sciences. And I'm still grappling with how far I want to go with this full metaphysical view. But he thinks that that information, both the CSI type that I've been describing, but other lesser forms, is really the primary stuff of reality, not matter and energy. And there's interesting things going on in quantum theory as well now that resonates with this perspective. He presents this as this metaphysics of information in a way that could be compatible with even atheists such as Thomas Nagel, who is a critic of neo-Darwinism, but nevertheless an atheist who's trying to hopefully come up with naturalistic teleology. And so this perspective might be shared by people from multiple worldviews to some degree. So I've been working with a colleague of mine, Paul Gould, who's a philosopher, and we're making the argument that just like in the three classical values, epistemic, there's a sense of oughtness or normativity about value. So epistemic ought is a person should form and retain beliefs that are justified, right? You don't just jump to a conclusion. You reach a conclusion based on proper steps of reasoning. That would be epistemic God, okay? Moral law, you're very familiar with, and aesthetic God. So is there also an informational kind of oddness? Does life functional CSI, cosmic, biological, and within intelligent life, is there a sense of oddness within at the information level of reality? Good question. So let's pursue that. I'm suggesting that there is. So for example, you look at the genetic and epigenetic information, that is the CSI in a living organism. Let's take a simple animal, a round worm, which as an adult has about 1,000 cells. And scientists have traced, not only have done the whole genome, sequenced the whole genome, the very first genome to be done, but also have traced the developmental pathways. We're talking about the developmental pathways of a fly to get the gyroscope and so on. There's going from 1 cell to 1,000 cells, every single cell cleavage step has been traced. So we know in great detail the exact developmental pattern. And we also know that you can easily disrupt this developmental pattern by introducing toxins. So there's this sense, there's this intuition that we have, that many people have from many worldviews, that there's a, when you have a natural kind of thing, let's say this roundworm, C. elegans, that it has within itself a kind of, it has information within itself that when properly expressed gives you the adult form through a developmental pathway. And there's a sense of oughtness here. You couldn't go in and as a scientist do mean things to these roundworms while they're developing and disrupt that information processing flow and block the achievement. But there's a sense of this is a goal-directed process, right? Within developmental biology, it's an amazing type thing. So there's a sense of oughtness here. This one a little more jolting. If we look at human anatomy, the rectum and the sphincter muscle here, you can make the argument that these were designed for certain purposes. It was designed for holding waste and excreting it. And so in the case of anal intercourse, there's a vast medical literature that has shown that when pressure is applied from the outside rather than from the inside, over time it does damage the sphincter muscle. And those who practice this form of sexuality, research has shown that about 1/3 lose normal bowel control at some point later in their life. Also, the rectum itself, because of the information content of in the development of this kind of organ, it has a very thin line that's very easily damaged by anal intercourse. And so the basic idea is that a vagina is designed for this sort of activity, and it thrives. Again, thinking of this not as in a moral term, but thinking in terms of function of a body part, okay? Obviously, there's the moral question on top of that, but just looking at the function of the body parts, this would be, there's a sense of normativity here of how a body part is to be used to be functional, to be used in a way that's functionally optimal. In a similar way, you could use a watch as a hammer. You could use it to hammer nails in your house, but likely you're going to do damage to the watch. There's a sense of informational oddness even to human artifacts that the gears, the designs, or if it's an Apple Watch, the digital the circuit boards and so on in there are designed for a certain purpose, and so. So you have the outcome, the functional outcome is supposed to be to track and display time. But of course, so that there is a sense of informational oddness about an artifact or about a body part or about a whole organism in the case of the roundworm that I illustrated. Okay, so normativity. Now, normativity on the personal level makes sense. You know, we ought to, as individuals, we ought to function properly as knowers and as moral agents and aesthetically, but there's also, I think, an oddness on the informational level. That is, that informational ought, that that, okay, so you have a universe that's fine-tuned for life and for scientific discovery. That implies that the universe ought to have life. That, in other words, having a universe that's fine-tuned for life with no life in it, that just seems incomplete, seems there's a certain sense of internal integrity or oughtness about this universe having life, and not just life, but intelligent life, since the universe is not only fine-tuned for life, but also fine-tuned for scientific discovery. That also implies there ought to be intelligent observers who could make use of that in the intelligibility of the universe. Okay. Now, from a naturalistic multiverse perspective, trying to have a there's often a meta-narrative in literature that I've been reading that there's still, even within a naturalistic perspective, a sense of sort of oughtness, not necessarily of human life, because that would sound anthropocentric, but of intelligent life. And this is, of course, is the idea of the universe becoming conscious of itself. And there's a feeling of oughtness about this, that even despite the difficulties of grounding normativity within naturalism, and there's a whole literature out there, naturalists trying to come up with ways to ground normativity in a naturalistic perspective, there's huge problems with that, but there's a drive, there's an attempt to do that. I mentioned Thomas Nagel. He, in his book, Mind and Cosmos, writes, value is not just an accidental side effect of life, but rather there is life because life is a necessary condition of value. And so in this book, in which he critiques neo-Darwinism, he again wants to have a view of the world in which God has no place, but he sees as he introspects as an intelligent being, he realizes the kind of oughtness, normativity in the way he thinks, in morality, and so on, and he's driven to that life is not just an accidental, there's a certain oughtness to life, and of course, since he's also read the literature from the ID community, he's very familiar with the complex specified information as being the unifying feature of life. So his own thinking here resonates with the view that I'm launching here. So here's a memorable way to put it. The first trait of value that we've covered is normativity. The second major trait is rarity, that values are rare. And here's a way to remember it. There's few ways to be reasonable, moral, beautiful, and alive, but many ways to be unreasonable, evil, ugly, and dead. Okay. So information is about ruling out possibilities, right? Information theorists talk about you generate information by saying no to lots of other things, and the outcome is information. So rarity. So there's many different ways you can imagine a universe being constructed, but there's a very small proportion of those that are life-friendly, right? Or in the case of biological CSI, some research has shown that if you take the possibility space, imagine different ways of arranging amino acids sequentially, there's a very small proportion of those that are functional, that is, would function as proteins, in proportion to those that are useless amino acid sequences. So you have a picture of a vast ocean of non-function with tiny isolated functional sequences, which some of which are proteins in actual life. So this idea of rarity is very clearly played out in information, both at the cosmic level and the biological level, and as well as at the level of intelligent life. In creating the text on this slide, there's zillions of ways I could have arranged text that wouldn't make much sense, right? Very few that would actually convey a message in English. So you have that rarity. So you've got, and I think ultimately, coming at this as a Christian, this resonates quite well with the Christian perspective that God is described as being holy, right? And this entails the ultimate in rarity and oughtness, that God is ultimate in being unique and also that we are to be holy because he is holy. There's an oughtness about God from which all value comes, epistemic, moral, aesthetic, and informational. Now, the rarity of value, I would argue, makes sense both from a Christian perspective as well from an atheistic perspective. So from a Christian perspective, God could have made many different possible universes. And he could have made many different ways of being good, beautiful, and alive. But within each of those possible worlds, there would be many more ways to distort each of those. And so the idea of evil or being a distortion of the good is a very similar idea. So each instantiation of value then is rare. From an atheistic multiverse perspective, you get a similar outcome, at least depending on who you're talking to. That is the idea that the proportion of good, beautiful, inhabited universes would seem to be very small compared to the rather dull ones that might much more likely occur. So my conclusion then is that life functional CSI is a kind of value, and I've argued for this by comparison with the three classical values, that they all share common traits of normativity, rarity. I skipped gradedness for the sake of time, but basically the idea that it comes in degrees, right? Degrees of justification, right, epistemically, degrees of goodness or of virtue, right? And degrees of aesthetic pleasure, also degrees of information. In fact, informational value, in some cases, is very exactly quantifiable in terms of degrees of how much information is to be can be stored in it. Like, for example, the guy at Harvard who stored something like 60 million copies of his book in DNA, and he was able to put it into DNA and then extract it out. It happened just a couple of years ago. Life functional CSI is a kind of value for those reasons, and that informational value can be seen on multiple levels, both in the world of persons and in also in personal entities. So you've got a universe fine-tuned for life. So the rare oughtness, there's a kind of a rare oughtness to it, because there's a sense that life ought to exist. There's people from many different worldviews who have this sense that life somehow ought to exist. And of course, once you have a universe that's fine-tuned for life, then there's a sense that universe would be incomplete if it didn't have life in it. So I'm interested in what you have to say. Questions you have about.
A few minutes for questions.
Thanks for your talk. I'm curious about your kind of endorsement of some of what Nagel says. Like, I know that you don't endorse everything about Nagel, but one of his main points is that, as far as I can tell, is that the universe has within itself rational beings like us, because at the fundamental basis of reality, electrons, for example, are rational. That their rationality is what allows us to be rational. And
yeah.
I find that a really strange and reductionistic view, and I wonder if you can just comment on that, whether I'm reading him right, or whether you would agree with him on that point, or whether you would critique that.
Yeah, well, he thinks that there are natural laws of teleology that are goal-directed within nature. Of course, these have not been discovered. This is just a hope, okay? And so in other words, he thinks that he's imputing to the universe some of the attributes of God, that it's purposeful, goal-directed by itself, without that it is its own sort of like an intelligence in and of itself. It's his best. So, but he's trying to make sense of oughtness, epistemic, moral, and so on. As it couldn't be just an accident. He rejects the reductionistic story, but his own story is just a leap of faith, I think. Questions?
I guess make one more comment about Nagel.
Yes,
So it seems like Dembski was saying that information is sort of more foundational or fundamental than matter and energy.
Yes.
And that's the same kind of thing that I see Nagel doing. And I find that odd. I would just say that there is no single kind of thing in the world that is foundational to everything else. It just is a world which God created, which exhibits many aspects, including an information aspect and a material aspect, and those aspects cohere together in a God-ordaining fashion.
Right.
Not that one is built upon the other. Like, information isn't the source of physical reality.
Yeah, and I don't sign off on Dembski's full metaphysics of information. I think it's a possibility to consider, but I'm more along the lines of what you described of ultimately, I mean, God is the one who creates and upholds the universe in a certain way, and it might have different aspects to that reality. Information is definitely an important aspect of reality.
One more last question.
Oh,
You haven't talked about consciousness, I don't think, in its place in all of this.
Yeah.
Do you have any?
Yeah, in fact, the very last thing, okay, so the third level, which I kind of didn't gave short shrift, was intelligent life has the ability to detect CSI and to create it. And so we are, in a way, mirroring, in a small way, God's ultimate creativity. So yeah, I think that's, and that completes the loop, because the naturalist wants to say the universe has become conscious of itself, you know, the intelligent life is the hero of the story. And it really is for many naturalists. That's their meta-narrative. For us, we say God is the hero of the story, but we are made in his image. And so we, when we examine our own functioning as knowers and doers and as aesthetically aware and also detectors of CSI, we also are more aware of how we are made in God's image, and it points back to God.
All right, that sums up this session. Thank you very much for coming, and thanks for all the speakers in this session. Thank you.